If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There are several different tiers available with perks to go along with each, including an exclusive series available only on Patreon. Each episode will feature a different individual who has committed murder in the state of Texas. We'll outline their crime or crimes and let the listeners decide if they are responsible for others. We sincerely appreciate all donations as they help cover the costs associated with research and production. Thanks, y'all. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Happened. I don't know what it was in me, but very, very early on, I remember trying to come to grips and to terms with it and just never thinking I was going to figure out who did that to her. And then also very scared of what would happen if I tried to figure it out, you know, and the fact that it would consume me and that in some ways would give whoever killed her even more, you know, than they'd already taken.
After the homicides of Mildred May in 1967, Becky Martin in 1973, and Carla Walker in 1974, all in the months of February, another homicide took place in 1977, on that very month. The fourth and final victim in what the press referred to as the February slayings was June Ward. June Ward's case was the least covered. Her murder resulted in only a few short stories in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and the Cleburne Times-Review newspapers. The original investigation turned up few leads. Daryl Thompson, a Fort Worth police detective at the time, told us that there just wasn't anything there in terms of solid evidence. June had been having issues with her vehicle, he told us, and they felt it may have been a migrant worker, an opportunist, as there was an abundance of shopping center, home, and apartment construction all around the city at the time. June's case went cold almost as soon as the murder happened, it said. But the lack of information and evidence does not mean that June or her case deserves less attention. Johnson County, Texas, sits due south of Tarrant County. The county seat, Cleburne, is virtually in the direct center of Johnson County. The heart of the town is about 32 miles directly south of Fort Worth. Cleburne began as a Civil War outpost called Camp Henderson, a place where military units would be dispatched to battle or to perform other military exercises. The then tiny town wouldn't be officially named Cleburne until 1868. At that time, the population was only 7,500. By the late 1970s, the population had slowly grown to about 18,000. The once agricultural center of Johnson County began to boom into a large town only after Santa Fe Railroads opened major machining operations there in 1898. June Merlene Mulder was born in Cleburne on July 28, 1951, to Mary Catherine, age 34, and William Othell Mulder, age 52. William worked in the rail car department at the Santa Fe Railroad, and Mary stayed home to care for their child. June was, essentially, an only child. Her older brother, from her father's previous marriage, was 29 years older than her. Her nephews were nearer in age, and June became very close to them. So close, in fact, that their relationships were more akin to that of siblings.
My grandfather had a kid in the 20s, got divorced, and then in the 50s, got remarried, and the same time his son was having kids, had my mom. So even though she was their aunt, technically, they were all the same age, and they, for a number of years, they actually lived right next door to each other. And, you know, I can imagine, I mean, they cared about her quite a bit and looked, you know, took care of her and were in some ways big brothers to her.
Cleburne was the picturesque archetype of a Southern American country town during June's childhood years. By all accounts, it was a great place for a kid to grow up. Everyone loved the sweet-natured and outgoing June, and even as she blossomed into a young woman, you'd be hard-pressed to find an individual who would speak negatively about her.
We were in the same grade, and we went to the same school from grade school on up. We used to play a lot together, and on the weekends, I had a horse, and I would ride by her house and then some of my other friends' house. Yeah, it was kind of like my horse and I used to go visit all of my friends. She was in Bluebirds with us. She was always just the sweetest, quietest little girl. She was just different. Like, there was something special about her. And we all played together and did jump rope and kickball at Irving School. And I don't know. She just had something special about her. I've never heard anything bad about her or, you know, her growing up or getting into mischief or anything like that. Maybe it just never dawned on her that she could or would, because there was just, she was just a good person in my eyes, seeing as how I had that relationship with her as a child.
Perhaps closest to June was her best friend, Dorothy. The two became inseparable in junior high, after an incident that provides a clear example of June's character.
I met June in seventh grade. The school was Fulton Junior High in Cleburne. Cleburne's just this little small town. You know, you could run around in it and stuff and never have to worry about anybody hurting you or anything like that. But anyway, we just started seventh grade, and I was walked into the class. June was already sitting. I dropped my books. All the kids started laughing and thinking it was funny. But June, she got out of her chair, walked over, and helped me pick up my books. She said, "Don't mind them," and she smiled. After class, I thanked her, and before we knew it, we were best friends. One Friday after school, June asked me if I wanted to go to the movies with her and her mom on a Saturday. Well, I went to meet June at the movies, and her mom was a really sweet lady. And then I walked home with him, and I met her dad. He was an older man, and he was legally blind. I don't know, after that, June and I, we just started hanging out together, and we just became really best friends. We just did almost everything possibly, you know, that we could do. And like I said, it was just a small town, and we could walk all over town. She lived on the north side, and then I lived on the south side, so we would meet in the middle, which was town. And we'd just walk all over town on, you know, on Saturdays and try on clothes if we wanted to. All the salespeople knew we wasn't going to buy them, but, you know, they didn't care if we, you know, put them on. And we just act silly like, you know, kids do. June never met a stranger. She talked to everybody. I was a little shy person, but June, she never met a stranger. And she always had something nice to say about somebody. I never ever heard her say anything bad about anyone. We even met guys and stuff at the movies one time and started dating them. They were brothers. One's name was Teddy and the other one was Gary. We even double dated a few times. June was kind of crazy about Teddy, but I wasn't real crazy about Gary. I didn't go with him very long. And then eventually she met Mike Ward. I don't know, after that, well, it was just June, Mike, and I. We all hung out. I had a boyfriend, but it was kind of an on-again, off-again thing. But she and Mike, they hung out together, and she's just a sweet person. I don't know what else to say. I mean, I just never met anybody like her and probably never, ever will. I just loved her like a sister.
June and Dorothy did almost everything together. They were even married in a joint ceremony.
When my boyfriend asked me to marry him, I couldn't wait to tell June. But I had to make my boyfriend go in there and talk to my dad, because that's what they did back in the day. But anyway, he was real scared. He didn't want to do that, but for me, he did. And my daddy didn't make it easy for him. He'd asked him all kinds of crazy questions. He just kept on it until it was almost 12 o'clock. I wanted to call June. She was the first one I wanted to talk to, you know, and tell her about it, because I was so excited. And by the time that we had finished up with my dad, it was 12 o'clock. And June's mom, she didn't like calls that, you know, late or anything, so I knew better to not call her. So I waited till the next morning. As soon as I got up, and I called her, and she was asleep. And that just really aggravated me. It was like, oh, you got to get up, you know. But her dad says, no, she's sleeping. I'll have her call you whenever she wakes up. So when she finally did, she was so excited for me, and we were laughing and cutting up like girls do. Anyway, I mentioned, I told her, I said, hey, I said, you and Mike, I said, y'all been talking marriage. I said, what about us having a double wedding? And she got really excited, and she said, oh, I'd love that. And I said, yeah, me too, because I want to stand up there by myself, you know. That's what we decided to do. But I told her she better talk to Mike, and I knew I'd have to talk to Danny about it. And we did, and the guys was fine with it. And we just wanted, you know, just something kind of small, but we definitely a church wedding. My dad, he told me he wasn't going to buy me a big wedding dress, which I didn't want anyway. And she decided that, you know, we'd just go and get us some dresses. So that's what we did. I had a banquet dress that I actually wore. It's kind of a turquoise. And June picked out a really cute one. We went to town the next day, and she got her a little white dress with little white daisies in it. You know, what's going to do? We're just going to invite a few friends and mostly relatives, you know. And that's the kind of wedding we had. But before the wedding, the preacher was 2 hours late. That's not a good sign. it gave the guys too much time to, you know, back out. We were kind of worried about that. When he finally did come in, instead of taking June and Mike up there, you know, first, and then, you know, and then coming, you know, and getting me and Danny later, he just lined all four of us up. We didn't know what to think about that. But anyway, that's what he did. And all time that he was saying, do you take this one or do you take that one? He was getting us all mixed up. So June and I, we laughed after it was over with and said, wonder who we married, you know. he kept saying, Dorothy, do you take Mike? And Mike take Dorothy, you know, and Danny, do you take June? And then we was like, no, that's not right. You know, we had to keep telling him. We really didn't know. And so we kind of was waiting for our wedding certificates and everything to come in. When they did, because, you know, we didn't know, you know, what he had put on there. But he got the names right. it was a lot of fun. And we always had a lot of fun together. Anything that we wanted to do, it seemed like we just ended up laughing all the time.
June, last name now Ward, became pregnant while in high school. And although she dropped out to have her son, David, she obtained her GED shortly thereafter so that she could seek a nursing degree. Though Mike and June's marriage didn't work out, providing for David was always June's priority. She attended a nursing program at Hill County Junior College in Cleburne and completed her residency at Johnson County Memorial Hospital. She was licensed as a vocational nurse. June worked as a nurse at both John Peter Smith Hospital and the Edna Gladney Home, but was unemployed and still residing in Cleburne in February of 1977. David remembers his mom's hardships as a young mother, but has even more vivid recollections of their bond.
Well, yeah, she was really young when she had me. Now that I kind of know the story, her, you know, my dad, whom I never really grew up or remember being around, Mike, and I don't fault him either. Right? They're very, you know, literally still in high school, and briefly tried to make it happen, and that fell apart. And so, you know, very quickly ended up just being me and my mom, and then living with her dad, my grandfather, who was really kind of my, you know, looking back, my father figure in my life. But, you know, she was obviously, not only did I love her, but, you know, very obviously, like, everybody kind of loved her, and she had one of the personalities that, you know, and she struggled, and she had a hard time, you know, again, she was young and still trying to, you know, be a young woman and also be a mother. And it's interesting. I have a, you know, the memories I have of her are, you know, they're like, instead of like a nice and neat photo journal or photo book, you know, it's just a bunch of snapshots that are thrown into a box, you know? And so there's really kind of no order or no kind of, there's nothing written on the back of any of them. So I just have these memories, and I don't know who the people are. I don't know where I was, or really, frankly, like if I was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. So there's all these little snapshots of memories, you know, and a lot of them really good. You know, she was really proud of me. And one of my fondest memories of, again, it's the 70s, so you have to give her a break. But I remember her picking me up from school and sitting on my $16 man lunchbox in the front seat of the car unrestrained. And she's got the radio cranked, and I'm sticking my head out the window, singing at the top of my lungs to the song on the radio. And you know, if there was a friend in the car, she would brag about that. You know, I would know all the lyrics to the song after just hearing it, you know, a couple of times. And that of course made me real proud. But just, you know, lots of little memories like that.
Even at 26, June Ward was petite, standing only 5 feet 2 inches tall and weighing 125 pounds. On Thursday, February 17th, June dropped her son off at the Cleburne YMCA, where he was to compete in a boxing tournament. David kissed his mother and got out of the car. June headed to Fort Worth to meet a Haltom City man she'd been recently dating. It was the last time David would see his mother. Sometime around 3 a.m., now February 18th, police were dispatched to the 4800 block of the South Freeway Service Road to investigate an abandoned vehicle. A 1973 white two-door Chevrolet Laguna was blocking the thoroughfare. It was locked, and police found only a pair of women's shoes and jumper cables in the vehicle on the back seat floorboard. It appeared as though the car had stalled and the driver left the auto as a result, possibly unable to move it by themselves. The abandoned auto wasn't a particularly unusual police call, and it seemed like business as usual for the officers that answered the dispatch. There was, however, nothing usual or common about what this event, or at least the events that would follow the car being left on the service road. At approximately 4:30 a.m., a man was heading home from an all-night cafe, traveling west on West Fuller Avenue. The motorist caught a glimpse of what looked like a body lying on the curb on the 1,000 block of that road as he sped past. He quickly turned his vehicle around and confirmed that it was indeed a body and rushed back to the cafe. He'd just sat drinking coffee and making small talk with two Fort Worth police officers there, so it seemed like the fastest way to alert police. The body belonged to June Ward, as did the abandoned Chevy Laguna found just prior to the discovery. June's body was nude, wearing only what was described as a gold necklace. There was no sign of June's clothing or personal items, including a bluish-green blouse and blue jeans, a small brown leather purse, and her car keys, all items that she was known to have had. It was speculated that June also might have been wearing a red leather jacket, missing a button on the front, white sandals, and two rings. The immediate area provided no clues or evidence as to what happened to the young mother. A brassiere strap was found clenched around her neck. It was determined that she was killed at another location and dumped at the site where she was found. David was told that his mother was gone shortly after waking up.
Yeah, so the night, and I guess looking back, this is probably my lens to my belief that there's, you know, something beyond death. But the night my mother died, the last time I saw her, she had dropped me off at the YMCA, and that was the last time I saw her. And when I got back to Cleburne, a friend's parents took me back home, and I went to bed. And then at some point in the night, I remember waking up, and she was at the door, and she came to me, and she said goodnight, and she tucked me in. And I woke up the next morning, and when I woke up, that's when my grandfather told me, you know, briefly or basically what had happened to my mother, and that she was gone. And again, I was waking up, and I just remember being in a little bit of shock and disbelief and disoriented because I remembered her tucking me in. And as I kind of woke up, I realized that it actually happened a couple of times previously in the night. And then I also remembered that she was, you know, when she came to me, she was dressed as a nurse, which obviously she wasn't working that night. And of course, I think that took me a little bit of time to kind of piece those together, that, you know, what I experienced was, you know, maybe not a literal thing that had happened, but, you know, it was also very hard to accept it because I just knew she'd been there the night before. You know, obviously that kind of thing sticks with you. But when I got older and old enough to really kind of, you know, I guess, do research and, you know, do homework on such things, I did do some reading, and, you know, it turns out that's actually a relatively common phenomenon for loved ones to come to other loved ones, you know, when they pass. And again, I think that, you know, really the main thing that does for me is just, you know, that's a memory I have of her, whether it's, you know, real or literal or physical or not. But it also kind of gives me, you know, in spite of, I guess, doubts about a lot of things, it really kind of gives me at least some modicum of faith that there is something afterwards, because in some form or fashion, I truly believe she came to me that night.
Officers wasted little time showing June's photo to nearby businesses, though any clues they obtained doing this are unknown. The service road where the Chevy Laguna was found was just adjacent to a shopping center that contained a Kmart department store, a nightclub called Mr. Magoo's, and was at the corner of the South Freeway and Felix Street. Though many have speculated that June had been at Magoo's that night, it could never be definitively determined, and is thought by most to have just been that, sheer speculation. It seems unlikely, as many of June's friends have said that she did not go to that establishment, and questioning of the clientele, which consisted of mostly regular customers, could not place her there. June's family told police that she had experienced car trouble in the preceding few weeks and was carrying the jumper cables for that reason. A helicopter was dispatched, and aerial photographs were taken of a large perimeter surrounding the 1000 block of West Fuller, as well as a perimeter around where the vehicle was found, but the actual distance covered on either area was not specified. June's father told police that she was going on a date with her boyfriend who resided in Haltom City. Police later questioned him, but little is known of where June and the Haltom City man had been, or what they had done during their date. According to the man, June left him at approximately 11:30 p.m. to head back to Cleburne. He was quoted by the Fort Worth Star-Telegram as saying she might have stopped to eat after the date, so presumably the two had not dined during their rendezvous. He was cleared. Witnesses would later place June at a Cleburne drive-in restaurant at around 7 p.m., just after she dropped her son David at the Cleburne YMCA. Chief Medical Examiner Felix Gwotes determined that the manner of death was asphyxiation by strangulation, and that there was no direct indication that June had been sexually assaulted. However, John Underwood, a crime scene investigator at the Monroe County Sheriff's Office in Florida and a classmate of June's from elementary to high school, tells us that there was semen found on her body.
Some of my people that I knew back in Cleburne found out what I did. I'm a crime scene investigator. And they asked if I could find out anything about the case. When I called, it just so happened that the Fort Worth Police Department had reformed their cold case unit, and the young detective I spoke to had been put in the cold case unit from CSI. When I brought this case up to him in a telephone conversation, he looked it up enthusiastically, by the way, and told me that he was going to look for some of the evidence. He found it, and yes, they were able to extract a male DNA profile from some of the evidence they had left over. And they ran that as a test against what they knew at the time, a couple of guys that were prime suspects, and there was no match. They even got for one of those guys, they had to get a warrant to obtain a familial match from a surviving family member. I believe it was up in New York or New Jersey, somewhere like that. And it didn't match. The technology that you see reflected in the crime scene television shows, not just the documentary type, but the made up ones, the technology you see presented, 99% of that is real. However, technology is pricey. I mean, very pricey. So most agencies aren't able to pursue their cases using those venues because most states have their own state law enforcement agency group, and they maintain their own state labs that are, for the most part, state of the art. But sometimes they balk at doing certain things because unless there's more than one piece of evidence, it may be hard to use that one piece as a route to a conviction. Even today, a lot of attorneys are afraid to trust only in the DNA evidence. You have to remember that I think it was 86 or 87 was the very first case that DNA was the sole piece of evidence that resulted in a conviction. And it was the only piece of evidence they had. And that was a landmark. But a lot of lawyers still aren't very aware of all of the implications and all of the benefits, as well as ramifications that can come from DNA. And using that, trying to use that as evidence for a murder conviction. And you see these guys, oh, well, send it to CODIS on TV. Run it through CODIS. CODIS belongs to the FBI, and they have very stringent requirements that have to be met before they will even accept a sample for comparison. Once a committee meets and decides that they will accept the sample, and they do their own analysis and run it against their database, that committee has to meet again to determine whether or not they're going to tell you what they found, because there may be constitutional issues, legal issues that would prevent it. It's incredibly complicated, far more than it needs to be. I've testified a number of times at trial, and I know that trying to explain it all to 12 laymen, I'm not sure if I got through because it's a very complicated and convoluted process. There are no ins and outs because technology continues to advance and we continue to learn things we didn't know yesterday. So there's no way to say you know all the ins and outs.
Though the strangulation killed June, the perpetrator then bludgeoned the young woman, mostly in the head but also on the body, with what has been called a sharp, heavy object consistent with a hatchet or axe. They were able to ascertain such because little bleeding occurred as a result of the bludgeoning. The fingers on June's right hand were broken, indicating an intense struggle was likely. There was definitely a struggle, John Underwood told the Cleburne Times Review years later. I think she fought to the end, he added.
So this person spent quite a bit of time in the commission of this monstrous act. The very idea that someone would take that girl and do that, that's a monster. And I have daughters and granddaughters that I worry about constantly. Well, these days you gotta keep them close. But there are monsters among us.
After seeing the reports in the paper, a man called Fort Worth police on Monday, February 21st, to report seeing a hatchet over the weekend in the parking lot of the Kmart near where June's automobile was found. The police were unable to locate this item, however, let alone confirm that the hatchet was ever there. The object used as a weapon would ultimately be theorized to be a carpenter's hatchet or rigger's axe, a tool that has a hammer on one end and a hatchet on the other. June's homicide was cold almost as soon as it occurred. Lack of evidence, motive, and witnesses frustrated the Fort Worth police from the beginning. It was unfathomable to June's family and friends that anyone would want to cause harm to the beloved mother, daughter, sister, and aunt.
I remember even when she died, I remember my grandfather just at a loss for everything. Just I remember him saying, I just don't understand it. Everybody who knew her just loved her. I don't know why anybody would do this to her.
And, you know, there's so many things she didn't get to see or experience or and whatever. But then on the flip side of that, David didn't get to spend time with his mother, you know, as far as growing up with him graduating and him doing well in school or getting married or, you know, getting his first job or all of those things. So, you know, there's so many people that lose in that situation. So it's a ripple effect.
It broke my heart, you know, when she passed. And I'm going to cry. But I just missed her so bad. And it's just, I don't know, it's just not right.
David pushed up a chair to the radio in the kitchen at their home and awaited updates that would never come. He was stunned. He couldn't speak. Of course, his mom's passing would affect him for the rest of his life as he struggled to understand why she was taken from him.
What I tell you, like losing your parent, losing your I'll go as far as say like a boy losing their mom and their only mom and a mom they adore for, you know, even if she's not perfect, you know, it really is the gift that keeps giving. And it's unfortunately when that happened to her, I don't know quite the rhyme or reason, but neighbors or friends had given my family a collection of newspaper clippings. You know, obviously Cleburne, and I guess at that time Fort Worth, they weren't, you know, super big towns. So these were, you know, it's kind of a big event that makes the news. And unfortunately, like at that time, soon after that happened, I was privy to a lot of the things that happened to her and how she died. And you know, it just leaves a mark. You know, it's you know, I can't compare it. You know, that's the only internal loss I have. But you know, it was very violent, and you know, it exposes you to, I guess, a side of humanity that you know, you hope you're never exposed to. Somebody can be that. I don't know. You can use the term evil, and that would be every right. There's probably other terms for it, but. It you know, really just it leaves a big mark. And, you know, looking back as, you know, and then knowing a little, having kids of my own and, you know, just experiencing their kind of developmental journey, I say it's the gift that keeps on giving, because, you know, when you're 8 years old, you can only process so much. And then you hit, you know, the next developmental phase. And, you know, and then something else occurs to you. And then there's, on top of that, for me, you know, I had to leave my my pop behind. It was kind of, you know, he's my father figure, and I left. He was, you know, an old man, and I think it was determined he wasn't really in a position to take care of me, so I had to move with family. So I lost my mom, and then shortly thereafter, I lost him, or effectively lost him, because I didn't live with him anymore. And so there was guilt of leaving him behind, but. You know, and then when, you know, you hit your teenage years, and that for me personally, that's when it kind of started to unravel. And then, you know, honestly, by the time I was, you know, 25, I was really just kind of a mess and at a loss for what to do with myself. But, you know, when this happened, I don't know what it was in me, but very, very early on, I remember trying to come to grips and to terms with it and, you know, just never thinking I was going to figure out who did that to her. And then also very scared of what would happen if I tried to figure it out, you know, and the fact that it would consume me and then in some ways would give whoever killed her even more, you know, than they'd already taken. You know, one of the things I think with tragedy and trauma is in some ways you start to identify with, and it becomes part of your identity. I'm Dave, you know, the guy who lost my mom brutally when I was 8 years old.
June's romantic interests were ruled out quickly, and the only other known person of interest came in the form of an incident that occurred shortly after her death. A 29-year-old white male was arrested for the abduction of a 19-year-old Haltom City 7-Eleven night manager. The young woman was taken from the convenience store located at 1325 North Beach Street. The man, wearing a brown paper bag on his head, walked into the store carrying a can of chemical spray in one hand and a pocket knife in the other at about 1 a.m. early Wednesday morning, February 23rd. He didn't ask for money and instead forced the woman into the passenger seat of her own car. He climbed in after and began driving. Holding a knife to the young woman's side, the man traveled south on 121 toward Fort Worth and turned south on the South Freeway. He stopped the car suddenly around the 12,000 block, and the young woman was able to escape the vehicle unharmed. She called police from an unknown location. The police retrieved her, and while returning to the store in the patrol car, she saw the man walking along the South Freeway service road. The suspect was arrested. The man was questioned in regard to June Ward's homicide, but was cleared by a polygraph test. Both the Fort Worth police detective who investigated the case, Daryl Thompson, and June's high school friend, John Underwood, now a crime scene investigator at the Monroe County Sheriff's Office in Florida, believe the perpetrator to have been a transient worker.
I did note that they said she was bludgeoned with a hammer or an axe, and I spent a little time doing construction work, odd jobs, and one of the implements I thought I wanted to use until I tried it and hurt myself badly with it was a tool called a roofing hatchet, or a roofing hammer, specifically made for guys that nail down asphalt and cedar shingles. It has a hammer face on one side, but the backside, instead of being a claw to pull out nails, it's a small hatchet blade. And if it were a transient worker, for example, that would be the tool he would have with him. But again, I've never read the files, and I had no access to them whatsoever. In order to do a reconstruction, I had to have everything from witness statements, crime scene photos, crime scene reports, medical examiner's reports. You have to have all of those things in place to even consider a full-on reconstruction. As far as the DNA goes, the DNA wasn't well preserved because DNA wasn't even in anybody's vocabulary at the time she was murdered. At that time, all they had access to was blood typing. I'm just guessing here, and I'm not trying to make the detectives look bad, but they probably assumed that all of the blood there, because she had been brutally bludgeoned, was hers. When I began to look into it, most departments, even some large police departments, cannot afford to have a full-time dedicated cold case squad because they're so overwhelmed with new cases coming in. Homicide cases never close. There is no statute of limitations. They never close until the judge bangs the gavel and says, okay, this guy goes away for it, or the police can prove this guy that did this, he's died. He no longer exists. they never got back to me about what specific DNA profile they developed. I was only told very exuberantly that they had developed a male profile. And then later, oh, maybe 6 months later, very disappointingly was told that it did not match any of their suspects. I waited maybe another 6 months and contacted again, but their cold case unit was being run by a lady detective. I don't remember her name, but she was not very open to discussing anything with me. It's hard to know when you talk to someone on the phone. Am I talking to a detective or am I talking to a used car salesman that wants me to think he's a detective? So I understand her reluctance. And the last time I called, they no longer had a cold case unit even working. From my position as a CSI, I deal with physical evidence. And my evidence, it can sometimes be exculpatory, but evidence doesn't lie. At this point, my feeling has been from the moment I got involved, if enough attention could be drawn to this case that would put it on a national television network or a national radio network, somewhere, God willing, some person would say, oh, you know what I remember? I remember that night I saw this. There's no one on this planet that would love to see this monster brought to justice any more than I would.
Another theory, though, has been brought to our attention by June's best friend. This theory hasn't, to our knowledge, been explored by law enforcement.
The last time that I saw June, I was working at 7-Eleven at the time. And by that time, I already had four little girls. She, of course, had David. She came in. She wanted to tell me something, but I could tell that she did. But I had customers. I had to get rid of the customers first. And I waited on all them. And she and I was talking. And she said that she had met someone. And she was very excited about it. And I asked her who it was. And she said, well, I'm not going to tell you his name. And I said, what do you mean you're not going to tell me his name? And she said, well, I'm not going to tell you right now. And I said, okay, like that and everything. And I could always get stuff out of her, you know, eventually. It just took a little while. So I said, well, tell me a little bit about him. And she said, well, we went to school with him. She said it was in a grade above us. So I said, well, tell me something about him. And she said, I'm just going to tell you he's tall, dark, and handsome. And he was a grade above us. And I thought, okay, you know, I'm still going to get this out of her. So I said, well, come on, tell me his name. Well, about that time, a guy that we had also went to school with, and he was a big flirt and everything, and he just came over and he started talking to us. Well, I kept trying to get him to leave, and James tried to get him to leave, and he just, you know, he just wouldn't leave. And by that time, I had some more customers. So I went to wait on them, and June and him stood there and talked for a second or two. And next thing I know, she's waving at me and going out the door. And that's the last time I saw her. So I never knew anything about a guy from Haltom City. Maybe that's where that guy lived. I just didn't know. They committed suicide, supposedly, is what it was. Another granddaughter, one of the younger ones, she and I was talking, and I told her just about all my classmates are, you know, passed away. And I'm older than them. And she said, really, Nan? And I said, yeah. I said, I've been keeping a, you know, a list of them and stuff, and once it's passed. So she started looking at it, and she said, Nana, she said, do you realize, she said, that these people and everything died 2 weeks after June did? And I said, no, I haven't noticed that. So she pointed it out, and ever since then, I've been kind of digging. I just thought it was kind of strange. It said in the newspaper and everything that he came home, he found her, that she had committed suicide. And then he calls a relative, you know, well, before the ambulance got there, he committed suicide, or he shot himself, and he died on the way to the hospital. I just thought that was kind of strange. I never heard of anybody calling somebody and then, just, you know, turning the gun on itself. To me, that didn't make a lot of sense, but I thought it was kind of strange when I was mentioning it to David, and David said that he remembered that, but he said he thought that it happened before because he said he remembered his mom talking about it. It was just 2 weeks after, because I've already checked it and rechecked it. So if she was talking, maybe she was talking about him in front of David. David told me then that, you know, that, yeah, that was his second grade teacher. And I thought, whoa, wait a minute. You know, that would be a perfect way for her to get reacquainted with him. He also was a grade ahead of us in school, and he was tall and dark, and he was handsome. So to me, that just seemed like that was the guy. I thought maybe she might have found some jewelry of June's, or maybe, you know, just I don't know, maybe found out something, you know, and maybe he shot her and then he shot himself. David said that they did get some DNA off of her, and he's got brothers. And he said, you know, they would probably be a match, but I don't know how anybody would reopen that. Like I said, that was, you know, that's kind of my theory, you know, and stuff. But I did think it was kind of tied in, if that was him that she was seeing, which I'm pretty sure it is. So, you know, how would you open that up? David told me he was a truck driver, and I didn't know that. And I thought, well, you know, if he was driving the truck and he saw June's, you know, thing, you know, maybe he pulled over or, yeah, I don't know. All speculation, what happened.
For some reason, in my inner timeline, I had my second grade teacher dying before my mom died. And it was, you know, it made the rounds in the school, and it was, I guess at the time I was told it was a double suicide, or, you know, a suicide homicide where the husband had killed the wife and then killed himself or something along those lines. And I just always assumed that happened before my mom died. But Dorothy said one of the last time she saw my mom, she was working, I think, at a 7-Eleven, and my mom came in to talk to her and said she was seeing someone new, but he was married. He's tall, dark, and handsome guy, but he was married and was a little bit reluctant to give her the name. And then one of their mutual friends came in the store and started talking to him. So she didn't have a chance to talk to her anymore about it or get the name. So she was talking about the suicide murder that had happened. And of course, you know, I only remembered one when I was a kid, and I'd be surprised if there are more than one. And sure enough, it was the same couple, aka my second grade teacher. And then she insisted that it had happened, you know, a couple of weeks after my mom had died. I just didn't think that was the case. And so she looked it up, and it did, in fact, I think, the date was March 10th, 1977, when the couple died. And so, again, she's just speculating, but maybe it went south with my mom, and her thought was maybe he killed my mom, and that the wife found out about it, committed suicide, and then he committed suicide. But again, that's all, you know, really kind of speculation and maybe pulling two things together that may or may not be related. But I didn't realize, and now I do, that did happen literally like 2.5-3 weeks after my mom died. So from a timeline perspective, I guess that's kind of interesting and nothing I'd ever really considered. I do remember my mom mentioning my second grade teacher at one, you know, on one or two instances. Why would that come up? Why would she mention? But, you know, she was my second grade teacher. So I don't know. But can you think? I think Dorothy mentioned a coat she got, you know, a leather coat that she got from your boyfriend. And what is that, 40 years ago now? A lot of that stuff would have been a lot easier to figure out and trace 40 years ago.
Funeral services for June Ward were held at the Pitts Dillon Funeral Home in Cleburne. She was laid to rest at the Rose Hill Cemetery, also in Cleburne. But June's story doesn't end there. Though the tragic death of June Ward altered the lives of so many, all of whom still live with the devastation of her loss to this day, she is remembered and loved by those she touched. A couple of years after David was born, June gave birth to a baby girl, who she gave up for adoption. Because she was so young and taking care of one child was a struggle, June decided that her daughter would have a better life with those who were better equipped to provide.
And I think one of the things that was a real big shift in my view of everything was when I met my sister. I didn't even know I had a sister when I was growing up. And then after my grandfather died, and I'm assuming because the family agreed not to tell me while he was alive, they told me that I had a sister. I think I was 18. And it wasn't until I was 25 that I met her. And that was a really, and I think that actually in a lot of ways really turned me around. One, it was amazing to meet her, and she's an amazing woman, and great to, you know, it's a roller coaster of, you know, on the one hand, I'm really sad I didn't have my sister growing up. The next emotion is you're really thankful that she didn't have to go through, you know, the things that I had to go through. And then just, it's really hard to describe the emotional roller coaster that is. And she had always wanted to meet her mother. And I'm the one who had to tell her that she wasn't going to. And I'm the one who had to tell her what happened to. And it wasn't my mom anymore. It was our mom. And so I found myself kind of stumbling on even telling the stories. And our mom. And it really kind of, I don't know, that I think the net result of that is, besides being lucky enough to meet her and have a relationship with her, is it really kind of changed my it wasn't just about me anymore. And that was really helpful to do. And even, you know, at the time that I met her, I was living in Houston, about to move to Austin to go to school at UT, and didn't have a car. And so I took the bus up to Arlington, and her husband were going to pick me up at the bus station. And I remember standing inside the bus station, looking out the window. And I remember about 50 yards off, a car pulled into the driveway, into the parking lot. And I just got it. I looked in the passenger window and I, you know, essentially saw my mom and just got a chill and knew that was her. And of course, probably made her very, very uncomfortable the first, you know, half hour that I met her, because I was just mesmerized at how much she looked like my mom and just kind of shocked and stunned by that. But obviously, no doubt.
I always very much wanted to find my birth mother and thank her for what she did for me, because I knew she did give me a good life making that choice. But it was always very important to me. And I'd actually tried to find her before, but wasn't able to. So one day I get a phone call from my dad, who tells me that he received a letter from the agency that I was adopted from, that they had updated information in my file. So he gave me the number to call. I called and they told me about Dave and that Dave wanted to speak with me if I was open to it. So they gave me Dave's number. So in the matter of an hour, I was talking to Dave for the first time, which, you know, at that point I knew nothing about June and that she died. And so there really are not words to describe that whole feeling, that very surreal. You wake up one morning and a couple hours later, you're finding out about her history, because I asked about our birth mom, you know, and where is she? And so he's the one that actually had to tell me what had happened to her. And for me, then, this was pre-internet days. This was '95. So actually, later that evening, we went down to the downtown Fort Worth Public Library and looked up old microfilm. And that was the first picture I ever saw, is the newspaper article about her death. That's the first picture I ever saw of her. And it was like looking at a picture of me, because we look very much alike. And so that was very... very emotional. And it was very hard for me, because in my mind, I was always going to be able to meet her and thank her and tell her I was okay. And whenever, even though she died many years before, I was just finding out about it. So it was actually a grieving process for me that I was never going to get to meet her. Dave did come and we started talking, and meeting him for the first time was... for me, it filled in a lot of pieces about my life, and it was, the strangest thing is how we thought a lot alike about things. So even though we'd been raised separately and in different kind of homes, it was just very strange to me that there was someone whose thought processes were like mine. So that was just very wonderful. It's been wonderful for me. Even this many years later, Dave and I have a great relationship, and I consider him a blessing in my life. And, I'm extremely sad that June could ever know that I'm okay and that I turned out okay, that she couldn't know my kids, her grandkids, and that she wasn't able to know that Dave and I not only reconnected, but are close and have a great relationship. And I know that would make her extremely happy. And it's very sad for me. It's very sad for me. I never got to meet her. I never will. But it's also sad that she never got to know that the decision she made, that I know was hard for her, worked out well for me, and that Dave and I found each other again and have a great relationship. Well, for me, the whole thing is just that still, this many years later, I found out about June in '95, and still I just have a lot of sadness. So even though I never knew her, I did know her, you know, and she was such an important part to my story and to my life. And I mean, her difficult decision put me on a path to where I am now. And I so wanted to thank her for that. And I just overall feel just sad that her life ended like it did, sad that Dave had to go through what he had to go through, and sad that I never got to know her and that she never got to know me and know that everything's okay. I know he often tells me what a blessing I've been to him and how it helped his life and helped him become who he is today. But I don't know that he realizes how much he's blessed me too. And our relationship is a nurturing thing for me, and it's a positive thing for me, and has brought peace to me. And I'm extremely grateful for that relationship.
If you have any information about the murder of June Ward, please contact the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, the story of Allie Lowitzer, who went missing from Spring, Texas in 2010. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing the podcast with a friend, or by visiting patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast and making a small donation. The Patreon donations help us cover the costs associated with research and monthly charges, and we'd appreciate it immensely. We'd like to thank Diana Kirkley, Morgan Bernhall, Dorothy Williams, and Detective John Underwood for their help and contributions to this episode. Also, we cannot express in words how grateful we are for the support and contributions of David Ward and Jenna Howard. Thanks so much, y'all. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. We can be contacted on Facebook or Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas about the cases we cover, post pictures of those cases, and discuss many other cases from practically everywhere, so please join in. Also, for thorough, well-presented, and often undercovered unsolved cases, please be sure to check out thetruecrimefiles.com. Thetruecrimefiles.com is one of our favorite resources for interesting true crime. Give it a look. We're sure you'll be happy you did. Thanks for listening, y'all.